The next case is 08-352, Disciplinary Counsel versus Jeffrey J. Hoskins. Mr. Johnson.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. As the court well knows, in Ohio, disbarment is professional death from which there is no resurrection. In the last 50 years in Ohio, three judges have been disbarred. Judge Gallagher, who was convicted of felony distribution of cocaine, Judge Mosley, who was convicted of 6 counts of extortion, and Judge Catalinas, who stole money from a friend while a judge. He was managing the friend's financial affairs and then refused to participate in the disciplinary process. Respondent has been charged and tried twice on criminal charges related to these disciplinary charges, and he has not been convicted of any crimes. No client of the respondent has complained about the conduct which is the subject of this disciplinary action. And no lawyer who appeared before the respondent has complained about his conduct on the bench, absent the prosecutor, Mr. Grandy, who has twice attempted to have Judge Hoskins disqualified from cases involving the APA because of his alleged ownership in the Fifth Third Bank building. Disbarment is too harsh a penalty for the misconduct that respondent committed. There were originally 9 counts against respondent. One of them was dismissed by the board. Of the 8 remaining, I submit that 4 of them are the heart of the matter.
Are the criminal charges over?
Over? Yes, sir.
Tried and found not guilty twice?
Tried to a jury. A number of the charges were not guilty. Some of the charges were hung. Those were retried and all found not guilty.
All right. So. The criminal matters are resolved as far as your client is concerned.
That's true.
And there are no more hanging around on the horizon at this
point. That's true.
And the appropriate penalty, you believe, is?
The appropriate penalty depends upon how this court judges some of the recommendations of the board. It is clear, I believe, that the respondent has no ownership in the Fifth Third Bank building, and yet the board found that he was involved in a scheme, masterminded a scheme, and that he has secret ownership in which Mr. Ulig is a straw man. If this court believes that, then a harsher penalty would be in order. Another novel and pivotal count is the count involving David Bliss. David Bliss was a felon and a con man who successfully conned respondent out of $25,000 a number of years ago. He came back in town, reestablished contact, and said, I want to square up with you. Unbeknownst to respondent, Mr. Bliss was working with law enforcement in a sting. In all of those conversations, Mr. Bliss was wired. So Mr. Bliss was trying to get the respondent to commit a crime. Respondent was trying to get his $25,000 back, and that maneuvering, that dance, took several forms. During that process, respondent disclosed the situation to a state court judge looking for advice, Judge Lohman. He was referred to Judge Herman Weber on the federal bench. He talked to Judge Weber. Judge Weber referred him to Mr. Hunt, a federal prosecutor. He talked to Mr. Hunt. He then retained private counsel, Glenn Whitaker, to try and get an understanding of whether the statute of limitations had run on Mr. Bliss's alleged fruits of illegal activities, which actually didn't exist. Or whether there was a money laundering violation. And if this court finds that those conversations and the judge's actions in those conversations with regard to Mr. Bliss violated the ethical rules, then a harsher penalty is in order.
When you say a harsher penalty, I'm not clear what you're advocating.
If he committed a violation with regard to Bliss, and if he committed a violation with regard to the Fifth Third Bank, in addition to the errors that he freely admits in the 2 estates, then an indefinite suspension would be an appropriate sanction. If the court finds differently on the Fifth Third Bank and the David Bliss case, then I think we're down into the range of a one-year suspension. But those are pivotal cases. The David Bliss case, as I said, presents a very novel situation. Those conversations were intended to be private. The respondent very clearly is trying to, A, in essence, con the con. He does make a misrepresentation about the value of the Fifth Third Bank building. He does make a misrepresentation about the ownership of the Fifth Third Bank building. He is talking to counsel all along the way, and when Mr. Bliss utters the words in a taped conversation, "This isn't really my money," or "This really is my money, we're trying to make it look like Eve's," who is his wife, the respondent called his lawyer back, and his lawyer called the federal prosecutor and reported this attempted money laundering.
Didn't the respondent, wasn't he told by Bliss that the money was ill-gotten, and that, as the board says, Bliss claimed to be involved in smuggling purported terrorists across the border, I guess claimed to respondent. Is that not, I mean, either whether it was true or not, he claims that to the respondent, and the respondent continues to deal with him. Does that not go to the character issue at least, or?
It goes to the judgment
wisdom,
issue.
Right.
It certainly does. And the respondent knew that there were allegedly two pots of money. And again, there were none. There was supposed to be a pot of money that David Bliss had from these illegal credit card transactions. And then there was a pot of money that his wife Eve was supposed to have from her parents in England, which was supposed to be legitimate funds. And the way they conned him out of the $25,000 to start with was his wife Eve told respondent that she was interested in purchasing some farmland that he had, and kind of implied that if he would loan her $25,000 to help this charity, she would be more inclined to buy the property. So, the judgment issue is, in hindsight, get away from this guy. The sheriff told him that. The FBI agent told him that. Unfortunately, he had $25,000 at stake that he was interested in trying to get back and tried to do so within the bounds of the law.
But is it
unethical to explore that completely?
But you have a judge, a sitting judge, engaging in conversations about how to use money that has been illegally gotten, and he continues these conversations. Why does that not fit, whether it was meant to be public or not, it's conduct he engaged in. Why doesn't that fit conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice and has the appearance of impropriety? Whether he ever intended it to be public or not, it is conduct he is personally engaging in even having the conversations.
As to the prejudicial to the administration of justice, I would submit that since he was getting legal advice and attempting to do it to see if there was a transaction that could be structured legally, those conversations don't hinder the administration of justice. As to the appearance of impropriety,
But
I
to
agree.
Have conversations as to whether you could structure it legally tended to fall along the lines of, has the statute passed so that this illegal money can be now used? It's not, I mean, how can a judge engage in conversation saying, okay, you can use this money now because your statute's passed, even though you got it illegally?
That's the question. If it's legal to use, if it were legal, to simplify the question, if it were legal to use stolen money 5 years and a day after the crime, would it be unethical then to make a transaction with the thief 5 years and a day after the crime was committed when the statute of limitations on that money had passed?
And you don't see a problem with a judge having a conversation like that?
It has an appearance of impropriety, but it's not hindering the administration of justice if he's exploring whether or not the transaction could be done legally. And ultimately, the suggestion is that in disciplinary counsel's brief, that the judge kept on this track long after he had learned from his lawyer that it couldn't be done. If you look at all the people that he told along the way and the fact that his lawyer picked up the phone and called the federal prosecutor, I think the evidence is pretty clear that that deal was terminated when Bliss said, "This is really my money from illegal gains and not my wife's. We're just trying to dress it up that way."
Counsel, it strikes me that when one is owed money from someone that you have good reason to believe is engaged in a pattern of various criminal activity. And that's the status of this gentleman, isn't it?
Yes.
And the judge had good reason to believe that he had various criminal enterprises that brought him money. Would it make, it seems to defy common sense to believe that that known criminal starts segregating and aggregating funds and keeping track of it, and that whatever money he has, that is the criminal, or controls, isn't a blend of monies that may have been made legitimately together with monies that were made as a result of criminal activity.
I think the representation that Bliss made was that this was from the credit card fraud that he was released from jail in 1999 from. And again,
and that he had been pure as the driven snow ever since he came out of jail.
No, he clearly wasn't. He had attempted to sell some flags that allegedly came from the World Trade Center on 9/11. But the funds that he said he had amassed and hidden were allegedly from this pre-1999 credit card fraud. It's a matter of where's the line? How much can a lawyer or a judge explore his or her rights in a transaction like this? Is it unethical to even think about it? Is it unethical for the judge to have lent $25,000 to somebody who later was accused of selling fake flags from the 9/11 tragedy? I mean,
if he said if the what was stolen was a valued family heirloom, and he said, "Yeah, I'll take you out there and dig it up and give it back to you," that would be different, wouldn't it?
It would be exactly the same. The judge would have to explore his right to legally possess that. It wasn't a matter of whether he could get away with it. It was a matter of whether he could legally do it. The number of people that he told about the facts that he was presented with show that he wasn't trying to hide it. He was trying to get a good answer on it, and he didn't know the answer. So talking to a federal judge and a federal prosecutor and a privately retained lawyer show his interest in trying to get the right answer. And that issue, the misrepresentation that he made to David Bliss about the ownership of the building, is the only fact in the Fifth Third Bank building issue that led the board to believe that he was an actual owner. The corporation was sold. The corporation clearly owns the building. The bank accounts, the lease payments, the maintenance on the building, the APA's understanding of the lease, all goes to show that the transaction is exactly as it appears to be. Now, clearly, he bought the building before the APA lease was signed with the intention of leasing it to the APA, and when he realized there was a statute that might impact that, he contacted Ruth Dangle to try and get some guidance on it.
I'm going to interrupt you there. He had to have a statute tell him that might be a conflict of interest when the APA appears before him in the court, that he would be leasing to them. He had to have a statute to tell him that was maybe a conflict. They had to call Ruth Dangle to decide that's a conflict. I guess if that was isolated incident, okay, but that's part of a pattern of misconduct after misconduct here, isn't it?
Well, it's part of a pattern of him seeking guidance when he's up against something that he doesn't understand and of attempting to do it correctly, which he did in the case of the Fifth Third Bank. It's the way it's done is past the scrutiny.
I interrupted you, but I do want to get you to the Fifth Third Bank because
yes.
I know that Mr. Coughlin is going to argue strongly that he did own the Fifth Third Bank, and Mr. Euling thought he did, and the stock didn't transfer and all that. Do you want to anticipate his argument? When you really started out saying that he didn't own the Fifth Third Bank, but that seems like a subject to question.
Well, he started out owning Three Irish Sons Corporation, which owned the bank building. If you look at, there's a contract between respondent and his wife and Mr. Euling, which has been complied with one exception. The bank was not willing to split out the mortgage and make Mr. Euling the corporation responsible for $200,000 of it, respondent and his wife responsible for $60,000. But the bank building is the collateral for that loan, as well as respondent's house. Now, Tom Shuttle, the ex-president of the bank, said that it was his intention to have everybody on the mortgage. They went through one transaction that was aborted because the right parties weren't on the paperwork. But Mr. Shuttle and the bank still don't have that because Gordon, according to the way Shuttle described the way he wanted the transaction, Gordon Ulig would be personally guaranteeing the obligations of Three Irish Sons, and he's not. So, you know, there is some ambiguity in the way the bank transaction played out, but Ulig is receiving the rent payments, he's doing the maintenance, he's got the signing on the checking account, he's paying taxes on the income from those lease payments. The only thing that there is to point to that respondent owns this building is the misinformation that he gave David Bliss when he was trying to con Mr. Bliss, which is admittedly what he was trying to do. Bliss was trying to get him to commit a crime, and Judge Hoskins was trying to get his money back.
Is it uncontested that the respondent would receive no benefit from a lease with the Adult Parole Authority, the lease of the building?
That is not a stipulated fact, but I know of no contrary evidence. The two estate matters, I think, are pretty straightforward. They were not timely completed. Respondent didn't segregate his attorney's fees, his attorney's time from his fiduciary's time. He didn't properly document the expenditures of the estates. But at the end of the day, he has correctly stated the amount of fiduciary fees and attorney's fees that were taken. There was no theft in the Harold Pavey estate. The heirs actually came in and testified that they were satisfied with the work and that they had told him that he was free to take fees as he went along. So he did violate a number of local rules in the way those estates were handled, but there was no theft and there was no misrepresentation. Even Judge Carey, who handled the Taylor Pavey estate, testified on day two at page 220 that when he reviewed the application, the first accounting rather, he knew from looking at it that respondent was disclosing that he had taken attorney's fees and fiduciary fees in the past between 1995 and 1997. The board seems to say that Judge Carey was misled. Judge Carey's testimony is directly opposite that. And as to the severity of an attorney taking fees without prior court approval and early, Judge Carey testified that if he had found an attorney doing that, he would have had his clerk tell the lawyer not to continue to do it, period.
You need to sum up, Mr. Jensen.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Coghlan.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, John Coghlan on behalf of the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. I'll start where Mr. Johnson started, which is talking about count seven, David Bliss, and the building. I think you have to look at the case carefully and examine what was being portrayed by the respondent in this case and what the evidence showed. He has always claimed he was trying to get his $25,000 back from David Bliss. If you look at all the evidence, I submit to you that really what happened here was he had an ongoing active interest in using whatever money he could get from David Bliss, and it wasn't limited to $25,000 return. You look at Eve Bliss's, now Eve Hutchins or Hitchens, testimony. She gave a deposition. She made it clear she was part of David Bliss's relationship with the judge very early on in 2001. Back then, the judge learned about this stolen money. Back then, he tried to get David Bliss to invest that money in a Christian theme park, buy a motel. $1.5 million was suggested as the donation or the investment in the theme park motel in town. And then when that didn't pan out, perhaps he'd like to buy $600,000 worth of property, real estate owned by Judge Hoskins. That's the background. And during that time period, Eve Hitchens testifies, is when the judge was giving, not he wasn't a judge at the time, but subsequently became a judge, was giving small amounts, which ultimately added up to $25,000 as a loan over time to David Bliss. It wasn't one time $25,000, here, Eve, go and try and find out whether or not you want to operate a bingo parlor for the Humane Society. He admitted in his testimony that he did no research whatsoever as to whether or not the Humane Society could have operated. Did they even want to operate a bingo parlor? He made no terms for this loan on any piece of paper ever. That was, I submit to you, not the truth. He had always had an interest in getting that money and using it in some fashion. And we know that because in 2005, when David Bliss comes back into his life, the very first day he hears from David Bliss, he meets with him in an out-of-county motel. And why are they in the out-of-county motel? Because there is a warrant, a municipal court warrant against David Bliss that's pending in Hillsboro. So he wasn't even going into the county. The judge knows that. He's aware of that. That's why they're meeting there. That first meeting starts the discussion of, well, what can we do? How can I invest this money? The next meeting is in the truck. That's when the judge proposes. This is one, a break from court. Proposes to David Bliss, a known felon, who's just gotten out of 18 months for another felony scam, proposes, well, see that building over there? I can sell it to you. $890,000. 8 months before, he had bought it for $253,000. Yeah, con the con, absolutely. Scam the scam artist, absolutely. About $25,000, no. He's interested in covering all of his mortgages and debt. That's what this is about. It's not a return of his $25,000. It's to try and obtain as much money as he possibly can that he believes David Bliss has, that he knows if David Bliss has it, and he's testified to this, David had to have stolen it. So that's the backdrop. And the assertion that he stopped trying to get that deal through when he was told by Attorney Whitaker, you can't touch this money, that's not accurate. He's told on December 29th by Whitaker, you're being set up. And he's already been told once before on the 22nd, don't touch this money. You really should have nothing to do with this money. 29th, I think you're being set up. Whitaker calls U.S. Attorney's office, talks to them, calls the judge back. I've told them, I think you're being set up. 7 days later, he's on the phone with Bliss again. You know, David, you can't say it's your money. Eve has to say it's her money. And the end of that conversation, which is recorded, which is an exhibit, he says, maybe Eve could borrow the money and you could pay her back. He's still trying to work this deal. It's not about the $25,000. Does he own the building?
He wanted to cover his debt on the Fifth Third Bank and the building and other whatever debts he had on his house. The record shows that, you're saying.
So it's simply more than what we've been hearing from his testimony at the hearing. Did he own the building? We submit he did. How do we know that? Because his interactions with Mr. Gordon Euling, his straw man. Mr. Gordon Euling is told by the judge after he's proposed the sale to Bliss, oh, by the way, I might sell the building. And for your time and trouble, I'll give you $25,000. What does that mean? The judge is going to walk away with $600,000 from the sale. He doesn't own the building, but he gets $600,000 worth of equity. Now, if I am Mr. Gordon Euling and I believe I own the building, am I not going to say, whoa, time out, what's the price you're selling my building for? I would think I would. Does he ask that question? Nope. He just thinks $25,000, an awful lot of money, Mac. In fact, that seems like an awful lot. Might be too much for what I've had to do here.
Well, take us through the transaction, though, in which where the board, panel on the board conclude that he really did own the building. This 500 shares of stock and that apparently didn't get transferred and
right.
So forth. I think that's the critical issue on whether and who owned the building.
Well, in the fact pattern, what we have is a situation where he learned he could not be the owner. Judge Greer is the one who said, hey, you better look at this. And he agreed, oh, yes, wow, this is a problem. I can't own this building and rent it to the Adult Parole Authority. So he's looking for some way to get himself out of that picture. And we submit that ultimately he simply sends up this sham appearance of, as though he has done so. What he does is he and his wife transfer the shares, which are in the corporation, first to his wife and then to Gordon Euling. The premises that Gordon is going to assume $200,000 of the mortgage, of the $263,000 mortgage.
Gordon Schuling.
I'm sorry?
Schuling, right.
Gordon Euling. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Euling, right.
Yeah, Gordon Euling is going to assume the $200,000 of the mortgage. He never does. That was his buy-in. He never pays a penny. He never signs on the mortgage. We've just heard that the banker said, oh, well, there were supposed to be other people. That wasn't their testimony at the disciplinary hearing. Tom Shuttle said, they asked me, could there be more than one person? And I said, no, one person on this mortgage. We're not putting somebody else on. He leaves the bank. Mr. Tim Priest comes in as the new president of the bank. He's not even approached about having Gordon Euling on the mortgage. It's entirely the respondent's personal responsibility.
Where's the title of the property during all this?
That's a good question.
Is it recorded? There a recorded title?
I don't think we delved into where the title was at that point in time. It was purchased by Fifth Third Bank initially back in March of 05. I assume that the title was in the bank in Three Irish Sons back in March of 05. That's where I assume the title was all along. But the question is, had he divested himself of his ownership interest in Three Irish Sons by simply handing a stock certificate to Gordon Euling?
Euling have to say?
What did Gordon Euling have to say? He considered himself the owner of the building. He was paying the rent, he was accepting the rent from the tenants. He was paying part of the expenses, but he had to negotiate that with the judge and his wife because he didn't want to have out-of-pocket expenses. So the judge and his wife took a little more of the expenses so that he wouldn't have out-of-pocket. He could pay for it from the rent that was coming in. But he considers himself the owner of the building. That's true.
Your brief, you say that Euling's testimony, maybe we've got the pronouns here, a problem. Euling's testimony established that he too, meaning Euling, recognized respondent as the owner.
Well, I think that what we're arguing there is when he's told by the respondent, I've got a buyer for the building, his response isn't, well, how much what's the sale price? If I'm the owner, I'm going to want to know why are you selling my building?
I thought you said in answer to Justice Piper's question that Euling considered Euling the owner of the building.
When he testified, that's what he said. What I'm saying is I don't think the facts justify that conclusion on his part.
So to get to where you are in your view of this case, it is necessary for the board to have assumed and for us to assume that Euling was lying when he said he owned the building.
I think he's testifying per his belief based on an assumption he has with his close friend,
well,
the judge.
He was either telling the truth or he was lying. I own the building.
I don't think I agree with you that he believes he owns the building and he does not believe he's lying. And I'm not telling you that he lied when he testified. I think he's mistaken in his belief because there is no true ownership on his part. He may believe it.
Well, now, as the chief indicated, legal title is vested in someone.
Three Irish Sons has title. Question is, who owns Three Irish Sons?
And who was the owner of the stock of Three Irish Sons at that point in time?
That's part of what we're presenting to this court as a big question. We do not believe that Mr. Euling was the owner of that stock. He had to have been responsible for $200,000 of the mortgage in order to be the owner of the stock.
But what did you prove in terms of the ownership?
He did not purchase those stock shares because he had never gone on the mortgage. He has no personal liability whatsoever on that mortgage. The building might go out from under him, but he loses nothing if that happens.
So the sole purchase price was the transfer of the mortgage obligation, which never occurred, and there was no purchase price in cash or any consideration that passed from Euling to...
That's correct. The only consideration was, I will take on $200,000 of the mortgage. There's a $253,000 mortgage. I'll take on $200,000. He has never done that to this day. He has not complied with that agreement.
But he has. I mean, if he's the owner of the building, regardless of who's on the note and the mortgage, he goes to sell that building, the mortgage is going to be paid off. So he's not going to get any proceeds except proceeds over and above the mortgage. This is Euling.
I agree that.
So, in fact, now if the mortgage gets foreclosed and the building isn't worth the $200,000+, then the judge and his wife are on the hook for the difference. But if it sold or was foreclosed and it brought more than the mortgage, but for the mortgage responsibility, that's going to be satisfied before the title changes, and then you're saying
the judge was trying to sell it.
If it's a surplus, it was going to end up in the judge's hands, and we're asking, what's the evidence?
The evidence is his own testimony, his own statements to David Bliss, his own statements to Gordon Ulick. At the time he's trying to sell it to Gordon Ulick, he's telling Gordon Ulick, you're going to get $25,000 from this sale.
By testimony, you mean his recorded testimony?
Well, he
didn't come into these proceedings and testify he owned the building.
No, he has never testified he owned the building at this point in time. He has testified that he told Gordon Ulick, you'll get $25,000 when I sell the building to David Bliss. Gordon Ulick has testified to the same fact. When Gordon Ulick learned that the judge was selling this building, I was going to get $25,000. That was good to me. If I'm the owner of the building, wouldn't I want to know what else am I going to get? What's it selling for?
If you were trusting of the judge, you could also assume the building sold for an amount that would yield paying off the mortgage, paying the closing costs, whatever else is involved, and $25,000 of profit, which goes to Mr. Ulick.
You could assume a lot of things, but I think what the conversation is.
If you're Ulick and you trust the judge, isn't that what you would think? Is that the person he sold it and he's gotten me a $25,000 profit?
You might well think that. But you might well also be operating under the assumption that really you're just a property manager here, and here I'm getting some benefit for doing this for my friend, as opposed to I own the building.
I can't believe, as an owner, I wouldn't want to know. You don't have any direct testimony of that, though.
I have Ulick and the judge agreeing that during the conversation they had with each other, that's as far as it went. You're going to get $25,000 for your time and effort. And him saying, well, that's a lot. That seems like more than I should get here. As opposed to any conversation, and they both admitted that, as opposed to any conversation about, well, wait a minute, what are you selling it for? What's the sale price? Since I own it, shouldn't I know what the sale price is? I mean, that's not discussed. That conversation, at a time before any of this becomes relevant or significant, tells us what their state of minds were.
How much weight should we give to the fact, apparently, that heirs of the estates where he borrowed their money, obviously violated rules, that they ratified because he paid the money back, apparently, and they're happy, or at least they're not unhappy with the fact that the money was taken and used by him for personal debts and then he paid it back. How much weight should we give to that? Well, clients are satisfied.
Well, I think there are a couple of points there, and I'm sorry I didn't get to this part of my argument, but it's very important. There's two estates. First is Harold Pavey Estate. And those are the heirs who apparently did not complain. Two of them came in and testified of the heirs in that case. That what they testified to was, we didn't know what he was doing when he was doing it, but when we found out, we were fine with it. So you don't have prior approval from the heirs in the Harold Pavey, you have subsequent approval. And I agree with that. But I would also point out, they are not clients. He was the lawyer for the estate. They weren't his clients, the estate was his client. More importantly, however, is the Taylor Pavey Estate. Not a single heir testified from the Taylor Pavey Estate. They're all from the West Coast. We didn't bring any of them in. None of them came in and said, we approve or we like it. What we do know is that they were never told about the excessive fees he took. We know that because Attorney McKinney's staff person, Lynn Morgan, said, we never sent the application for extraordinary fees to those heirs. They were never advised of that application. And what else we know is he knew in 98, that the probate judge and the first probate judge in the Taylor Pavey Estate had said your fees cannot exceed $9,381. He got it back in the form of a journal entry he had submitted. It was a blank journal entry to be signed. And in the court wrote in, total fees to be allowed, 9381. In 1998, January, he was told, that's the most you're going to take. He'd already taken 25,000. He never tells anybody he got this back. He later applies in 05 for the extraordinary fees he's been holding on to for 8 years. And he doesn't tell the judge, oh, by the way, the first judge, your predecessor, said I couldn't have more than 9,300.
Counsel, let me move you to the criminal matters, charges that were brought against the judge. Are you in agreement that those are all resolved now in the judge's favor?
Yes.
All right. His counsel argues that our prior disbarments of judges have all involved felony convictions, and that if we believe what the board found and what you argue was going on with respect to this building transaction and the true ownership, that those offenses would bring you to indefinite. And if we don't believe that, something less than indefinite, as opposed to disbarment. Could you comment?
They actually mentioned three cases. A third is not a criminal conviction case. Catalina's case is not, I didn't catch that. He found that, I didn't catch that. It's not a criminal conviction case, but I think what you have here, I'm not arguing anything about criminal activity here. I'm submitting to this court that there is egregious misconduct that spanned 10 years, that misconduct included numerous misrepresentations to the probate judges. Both probate judges received pleadings which were inaccurate, and they were an attempt to deceive the courts from understanding what he was doing with the money. In the Harold Pavey estate, $8,088 was not reported in the first accounting he submitted. He signed 9 pages of that account, and $8,000 was not in there. He later had to put that money back in. He was misleading the judge. It wasn't until that judge went and got those bank records that he found out, wait a minute, where's this $8,000? And his first answer to the judge was, oh, well, you know, there were expenses that we couldn't have receipts for, so I told my lawyer, this isn't an affidavit.
Well, is part of how we look at what is the appropriate sanction to disregard looking exclusively at sanctions for judges, because most of this has nothing to do with his being a judge, right?
I agree 100%. We've got personal misconduct, attorney misconduct, and judicial misconduct. And because of that, I think you're in a whole different ball of wax than you. That's why the Catalina's case is somewhat on point. He engaged in significantly less misconduct, I think, but he also failed to respond to the discipline system. Well, I think you've got a lot more misconduct here, including a number of misrepresentations during the disciplinary system that bring this to an aggravation level. You have $15,000 of fees that haven't been returned to this day because he doesn't think he should. Well, back in 98, he was being told, that's the most you can take, and he had already taken $15,000 more. So what we're submitting is that in view of all of this, what we have is 10 years of misconduct. He tries to hide his ownership of the Fifth Third Bank building from the public. He attempts to mislead the probate court in the Harold Pavey estate about the $8,000. He doesn't even mention it. It's sitting in his pocket, and he's holding the checks that the account says these checks have been distributed. He had them in his personal possession. He had been given them by Attorney McKinney's office. And if Judge Greer hadn't poked around, I don't know what would have happened. He files misleading pleadings in the Taylor Pavey estate. The application for extraordinary fees has a whole bunch of misrepresentations in it.
And he did not self-report any of this. Is that correct?
He did self-report one aspect dealing with the, I believe it was the press release in count one. Okay. That's the only thing that he self-reported. In count eight, we have the Scott Schaefer incident, the false journal entry to cover his release of a criminal defendant as a personal favor to a friend. And then in count one, he makes a statement about his employee passing a polygraph when he knew there were serious problems with that polygraph. This is to the public, the county, where she's going to be tried. And her trial hasn't been scheduled yet, but she had just been indicted.
You've used your time. Go.
We submit that the record fully supports the board's recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, you've used your time, but you may start with 30 seconds.
I Mr. Johnson, let me ask you that if I understood Mr. Coughlin's position, your client has yet to make restitution of $15,000. Am I correct in understanding Mr. Coughlin's argument?
I think I heard him say the same thing. I disagree wholeheartedly.
All right, what is your view on that?
The application that was put in, the account that was put in originally in the Taylor Payview estate showed the full amount of attorney's fees accurately. The judge made a note on there that he was going to have to verify those fees. I would submit that the note's easy to look at. It's an exhibit. The note itself is ambiguous. Judge Carey was the judge who sat on that case, and he approved the extraordinary fees that were asked for. As Judge Carey testified in the disciplinary case.
The short answer is, in your view, there's a judicial authorization for all of the fees?
Yes.
That your client has received, both attorney fees and otherwise?
Yes.
And they're all covered, and there is no shortfall of $15,000.
That's true. That's my position. And Judge Carey was fully apprised of everything that happened in this case by Judge Grant, by Judge Greer, who wrote him before he decided this application for extraordinary fees and said, hey, we've got some problems in Highland County. Look at anything you've got with a respondent as a lawyer. He looked at the case. He approved the fees. He testified in the disciplinary process. He has not reopened the case. So there's no order. There's no any reason for a respondent to repay $15,000.
How much money did your client repay?
He repaid the $8,088, which was an overpayment of his fiduciary fees in the Harold Pavey estate. And he did that before the hearing on the final accounting. So his lawyer said, I don't agree with the way you've calculated it. You need to pay back. He said, okay. He did. The board criticized the fact that he didn't do that in December. He waited until January, the day before the hearing, to do it, but it was done.
Thank you.
I think I've exhausted my time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Counsel, you're excused. We have an admission ceremony following arguments.